This is P.S. You're Wrong, the podcast where we talk trash about the things people love to hate and hate to love, and we're your hosts, Shelby and Matt.
2025, baby.
Oh my god, I haven't said that out loud yet.
Wow. Another year.
Shocking.
How many years have we been doing this at this point? When did we start? 2018?
I think this is our sixth, or this is, we'll hit our
seven-year
anniversary in June.
Oh my gosh.
When did Jurassic World come out?
Seven years of people just begging us to be done with this, but us continuing on, forging a path.
No, it's honestly the light of my life. Like, I was sad this holiday break. I was like, there's so much to talk about.
The
and
light
no one
of
to
your
talk
life
about
is
it
supposed
with.
To be your child, not your podcast. Like, don't.
Well,
say okay, that
I separate, you know, work and family. So this is my only passion outside of that.
Giving bad mom energy.
No.
Are you gonna
no,
want her to listen
no,
back
no, no,
to this?
No.
The light of my life is a podcast with 12 listeners
every year. Matt, can you just be positive? Honestly,
okay,
it's 2025. Can you just accept the compliment? Can you just bask in that love I'm offering?
2025, best year ever, probably. Nothing bad is coming in 10 days or however long.
No.
When is the inauguration?
Oh, I should know this date, but it's end of January.
Oh, it's end of January.
Today was the day that they certified the election. So
okay.
That's why January 6th is loud in our hearts, is there was a time not so long ago that day was hijacked by terrorists in our own nation. So
yes.
Luckily, it was a zero news day. And there was no overthrowing attempt or otherwise of
there were
the
good people
capital.
On both sides, Shelby, and let's say
hold space to... I hold space for all perspectives on that day,
yes,
for sure.
Mm-hmm.
We've really come through so much as a podcast, as a historic artifact, honestly,
yeah. People are gonna look back on this in the future and be like, wow,
on our episode.
They survived a Trump presidency twice. They
honestly, what were we even covering at that point? Like, where were we January 6th on our podcast? You know, like, what was that?
January 6th, 2021. I mean, we were not covering good stuff at that point, because that was during the pandemic and also January, dumpuary, if you will. And, like, God only knows what we were covering then.
Yeah.
Although maybe we were covering the Golden Globes,
which just happened
last night. I had to cover them for work, so they have gotten significantly less fun for me than they used to. But, you know, still an interesting show. Did you watch it all? Or did you just see clips?
I watched part of it. Okay. I watched Nikki Glaser. I'm a fan, generally. I think she did a good job. I think she's the right energy for that sort of crowd, where she's young and earnest and thirsty, but also just very clever and quick and good at eviscerating them on a... level that I appreciate. Anything is better than last year, obviously, but I can see her coming back. I think I liked her opening bit. I liked her opening monologue. I liked her other bits throughout, and generally good vibes.
Yeah, I thought she did a phenomenal job, and I feel like it really does speak to the type of person who they should be trying to get as a host. Like, yeah. I think in years past, they've been like, we need a big name to host. That's going to be what's best for us to get, like, people to tune in. But I don't necessarily know how many people are tuning into the Oscars because Jimmy Kimmel is the host. Like, Jimmy Kimmel is a well-known person, but, like, does he have a lot of diehard fans? I don't know. And also, I think when you're that big, it's like, you're busy with a lot of other things. It's not your priority. It's not like a big break or a make or break moment for you. You just don't care that much.
Well, and you don't want to ruffle feathers because right. It's like you want to be able to have Martin Short and whoever else like on your talk show the next day. And so you like play it safe or you kind of like make lame jokes that aren't really for the people.
Yeah, where Nikki Glaser is like, she obviously had the big Tom Brady roast moment earlier this, or I guess last year now. But otherwise, it's like, sure, she's kind of a well-known person, but not really. Like, I think if you were to show her picture to like random people on the street prior to the Tom Brady thing, like most people would not know who she is. But I think that is also fun because she knows that this is a big gig. She wants to succeed. She talked about, you know, running her set like dozens and dozens of times over the past couple of months with different, you know, at her stand-up shows and like really fine-tuning it to get to a spot where she felt like all the jokes are really strong. And I feel like you could tell that last night because there wasn't a lot of, there really, I feel like there wasn't anything that didn't hit. Like, even her jokes, even her least funny jokes were still more funny than some of the things that we've seen in past years. And her really funny stuff was great. She didn't do any, like, super overproduced big numbers or any weird gimmicks. It was all just, like, very sharp and witty and funny. And, yeah, I think overall it was a very good Golden Globes, like from that perspective, but also we got a lot of weird sort of interesting winners. I think this award season is very chaotic, which is fun to watch because it didn't feel like, oh, we knew who was going to win everything. The one thing that I will complain about though is that they cut the clips packages from when they read the nominees and instead did this bizarre thing where they showed like a wide shot of the room and then pointed arrows to where the different people were sitting. And it's like, why are we doing this? Like, who cares? What is this for? Like, it did, like, I can't imagine.
It's like a sports, someone's drawing on a whiteboard as they circle these actors' heads, like, and they're like, okay, they'll have to go this way.
And then sometimes it wouldn't work. So, like, it would say, you know, it would be reading off somebody's name, but then showing where a different person was sitting in the room. And obviously it wasn't, like, exact, so it would sort of just, like, have them in general spots. Yeah. And I'm like, I understand.
And it's an ugly, like, view. It's like, it's not, like, at least at the Oscars, it's like, oh, everyone's sitting in rows. It's beautiful. This is just, like, a crowded, like,
ballroom
cafeteria.
Yeah. And it's, like, it's hard for people to get to the stage. Like, even when Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart won for Hacks, which, like, is a, you know, well-known show, like, won Emmys, presumably you think these people are going to win. They were coming from the back of the room and sort of like weaving through people. But I just don't understand who thought, oh, you know what audiences at home would really like to know is like where these people are sitting. Because I feel like that is not relevant in any way, shape, or form. What I do think people at home are interested in is like sort of seeing what these movies are kind of about, because a lot of them they probably haven't seen. You know what I mean? Like, if we get a shot of Nicole Kidman like on the ground of a hotel room in Baby Girl, like, I think that's more interesting for someone to go, what is this movie about, than to see like, oh, she's sitting in the corner. And also from the wide shot you couldn't see who else she was sitting with, so it's not like, oh, here she is sitting next to so-and-so. It's like, oh, she's just sitting on the right and Selena Gomez is sitting on the left. It's like, what? So dumb. Anyways.
Wait, but I want to talk about, I mean, yeah, we can talk about the awards too, but I want to get your take as a celebrity journalist on the Zendaya jewelry situation.
Oh, yes. Well, so she showed up on the red carpet with a large diamond ring on her ring finger. Ooh. People were like, wait, is she engaged? And then I think like sources were saying yes, but has anything been confirmed?
Well, no. And at first I was like, you know what? We always do this whenever a girl wears a diamond. And it's like, I mean, she's always wearing diamonds. So I wasn't like that keyed in. But then someone pointed out that it's like, actually, she's wearing a full set of Bulgari jewelry, as she usually does. But that's the only piece that's not Bulgari. And then the most damning footage is during the show, a bunch of people were like coming up and like talking to her and asking to see it and stuff. So it was definitely giving like newly engaged vibes. Like Iowa Debris was looking at it, clocking it. And then like one of the Spider-Man producer came rushing over and like she held out her hand for her to see. So it seems like, I mean, they've both been profiled like late last year and have both stated how private they are and like how if things like that happen in their life, like they'll just disappear, like they won't acknowledge it. And you know, they're not annoying about it in the same way other celebrity couples are, where they literally won't be photographed together, obviously, but they do have a good distance in there. So maybe that is just like the announcement we'll get, where it's not really an announcement, but it's like we can put two and two together. Because yeah, it was just kind of like the way she was interacting with people in the room, I was like, okay, like actually, I do kind of believe this rumor more.
Well, is Tom Holland in something that's coming out soon? Because I feel like he just did a big photo shoot. And so now I'm like, wait, is he in something?
I don't know if he's in something. I know he's been promoting his beer brand, his non-alcoholic beer brand.
This says that they're, okay, People Magazine says Zendaya and Tom Holland are engaged. So okay. I guess they must have confirmed it.
Yeah, very cute. Honestly, it's like I try my best to not be a parasocial weirdo, and like the, you know, statistically might not last, whatever. It's not like love will be dead if they don't, but they are cute together, and I do like how they talk to each other and hype each other up. So and she looked gorgeous, so I applaud the energy of making that your debut of such a wonderful into the a wonderful year for them. So
yeah,
cute,
love,
cute.
Okay, shall we talk about the winners?
I hope she like has a big wedding though, so that I can get like a full Vogue spread of her fashion choices for that event, because that's like the only time where I'm like, okay, like the rich can thrive for a moment today, you know.
I guess, I don't know, like it seems like the type of thing that she wouldn't do, but I also am like, yes, Zendaya in wedding gowns, like even if she doesn't like, okay, actually, this is what I'm pitching for her.
Okay.
Private wedding, whatever, no photos.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah, fine.
But then for Vogue, she separately does a cover shoot that's just like her in a bunch of different wedding dresses in different, you know, settings or whatever.
Very
like
Carrie Bradshaw.
Whatever her next movie is. Yeah. I'm like, let me look up what Zendaya's next movie is. I'm sure we can time this out.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, even if it's just like an Instagram picture or like Law like reveals the dress, you know, I just want to see it. I just want her to give me that.
She's in something called The Drama, a romance film coming out with her, Robert Pattinson, and Alana Haim. Intriguing. Filming concluded in December, so.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it was produced by Ari Aster. So maybe it's a.
Oh, wow. Okay.
More of like a
collection.
Okay, rude. I don't think anyone's name in there was warranted that reaction, but whatever.
I mean, I'm just saying it's a interesting mix. I mean, and then Ari Aster did the Beau Is Afraid thing, and I'm just.
Did you even watch that?
No, of course.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Shelby loves to come out with some hot takes on things she has not investigated.
Anyways, speaking of things I have not watched, It Ends With Us. Oh my goodness. I was worried we wouldn't get to talk about this because the first bit of news broke as December, like as we closed down, like literally the day after we've recorded our podcast, it came out that Blake Lively was suing Justin Baldoni for sexual harassment on the set of It Ends With Us. And I was like, okay, like generally what's fascinating about this is that I don't think either person is a good person. Like I don't fuck with either of them. I think they're both probably pretty gross and lame and egotistical and like whatever. But what's interesting is that she sued for sexual harassment, which is a employment claim. So the legal process is different. And immediately everyone was like, oh my God, like this is awful. Like team Blake. And a lot of it was about how just like this argument that Justin and his PR team and the production team for his piece of the movie orchestrated an entire like takedown campaign for Blake Lively during the press tour for It Ends With Us. And so a lot of these texts are pretty damning. They're pretty fascinating, like just to see the PR strategy involved, where they're texting about like, oh, we can't put this in email, like, but this is working out perfectly. Justin's getting off so luckily, like all of this stuff is like, we're burying the right things. And honestly, we can't feel bad about it because it's her saying this stuff, but like, holy hell, like this all worked out. And so immediately everyone was like, oh, okay, like this was more complicated. Maybe Blake Lively was right. But then the next week, Justin Baldoni's team sues the New York Times. So this is not a countersuit to what Blake Lively is doing. It is instead a suit that will probably have no chance of going anywhere because they're suing for like the, I don't know, poor coverage of Blake Lively and not taking into account his perspective or reaching out to his team or whatever. And that's going to be like a really hard like suit to prove, especially against a vehicle like the New York Times. So really, it's a strategy for him to get his story out, for him to get his angle out. And so his whole thing is just painting her as like a very difficult person to work with, that she actually did get her way in XYZ and there was no sexual harassment because look at all these texts that show how annoying she was and how actually she was the one who invited him into her trailer when she was breastfeeding. And she was the one who had Ryan Reynolds like attack him. Like it was like, there's basically a he said, she said happening here on different legal grandstands. And so, of course, now immediately everyone's like back to hating Blake. And they're like, oh, yeah, I never believed her. Like, oh, she's such a fucking liar, like such a gross egomaniacal freak. Oh, cancel her forever. Justin Baldoni can do no wrong. And I just, the thing that's fascinating is like people just need to take a breath. Like, you don't have to be on a team here. Like, these are both very privileged, wealthy people with nothing but time and ego on their hands to try and win a war of public opinion. And as we saw with some of the texts around Blake's suit, it's very easy to manipulate the public. And the best thing we can do is just like chill out, because it's like, I just don't think there's sides when it comes to this, because even if Justin Baldoni's suit is true, like even if she was just a terrible producer and scene partner and whatever, that doesn't change the fact that, you know, women should feel safe and supported in a workplace. And her going through the sexual harassment suit is very different than her just like suing Justin Baldoni and being like, you ruined my life. Like, thanks for burying me. Like, I'm going to get you too. Like, I think there can be room to say that she's bad, he's bad, she's a nuisance, he's not necessarily great at working with women, and have all those things be true at the same time.
Oh yeah, this is just like, I feel like one of the most fun sort of entertaining pieces of celebrity gossip we've had, probably honestly since the Olivia Wilde movie debacle, just because it's so like low stakes. It's all of these people involved are like successful, rich celebrities. So you don't really have like the power sort of dynamic thing that I think sometimes is at these in these suits that makes it more depressing. And it also does seem like both of them are just truly heinous people and they hate each other and are now like willing to take whatever steps necessary, like beg, borrow, lie, cheat, steal in order to throw the other one under the bus, which is just making it like more and make, I think, both of them look increasingly worse. And I think it will ultimately sort of end in like one, both of their damnations, but in the same time, like neither, because they're both sort of rich and famous. Like, I don't think either of them is going to be a beloved sort of icon that they probably hope that they would. But at the same time, I think that they will have a steady career in like Hallmark Christmas movies from now till the end of time.
In 20 years, they'll have their comeback starring opposite each other in Hot Frosty 5.
I think the things that I found most interesting were sort of not even the elements regarding them. So when she initially like launched her case, I think the most fascinating thing was sort of like an inside look at this, at these like damage control PR firms.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, there really is a lot of things that they can do and a lot of things that they can manipulate that you don't even know about. Like,
yeah.
They have bots and stuff that can amplify social media things. So you think, oh, I'm getting this video because a lot of people think that Blake Lively's bad. And it's like, sure, maybe they do, but also, there's a lot of bots that are liking this and commenting or whatever to make sure that this gets into your feed so that it is part of the main story. So I just thought, yeah, it was a very interesting, like, in the age of technology, how much you can trust things or, and sort of trust like these like general vibes online and how much of that is artificially created. And then when it got to the other side, I thought it was really interesting as to how like media and, you know, like journalists, really anybody can manipulate a story. Cause there were sections in the New York Times piece where, yeah, it's like they say, oh, he was sexually harassing her. He was showing up in her room when she was breastfeeding, which like on the surface is like, wow, like that's really kind of creepy and weird and like is cause for concern. And then you see these other texts where she's like, oh, I'm in my trailer, like I'm breastfeeding, like come in and chit chat about this. And then turns out like she was breastfeeding in tons of different meetings and things. So it's like, oh, that was spun in a way or sort of pulled out of context. There was also a thing where in the New York Times story, they made it, or basically like when those videos of Blake Lively in the old press conferences or whatever came up, and it was a big deal that I think one of the PR people, and I think it was Justin, were sort of like chatting back and forth, and in a sarcastic way, he was like, you know, thanks for like doing this, like making sure she put her foot in her mouth or whatever. And she responded like, oh yeah, like glad I could orchestrate this entire thing, but in a sarcastic tone. But they had pulled those quotes out to make it seem like the PR firm had actually orchestrated the whole thing, which they hadn't. So it was just very illuminating to sort of be like, okay, everybody, like even when you think that you've checked your sources and even when you've read these articles, you might not necessarily know all of the details. And most people aren't even reading articles. They're just seeing headlines or clips or blurbs or whatever and informing opinions.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah, I mean, who's reading the 400-page document to get through this, and who understands like what requirements of proof there are at this stage of every legal action? Like, it's like we're just so quickly churning out content, reacting to things that we don't even take the time to fully understand. And then those reactions become news. And so, yeah, it is kind of just fascinating. And honestly, I'm like team, this doesn't matter. But also I'm like, yeah, like women, it can be complicated where a woman can be difficult to work with, and it can be like, she can be the most annoying person in the room, but you also don't have a right to like comment on her weight or like call up her, you know, whatever. Like anything that comes out of this, I think will make them both look bad. But I was fascinated by Justin Baldoni's text about Blake Lively as a producer, because that was just like, oh my God. Like I kind of like love it. Like she's just like the most stereotypical, like unlikable.
Wait, what did she say? I'm like,
she was like there were all these like things where everyone talked about how she kind of took over. She was like insisting on her own hand in the wardrobe, whatever. But then on top of that, she decided to do her version of a cut. Like she edited an entire cut of the film. And then they presented the two battling final products. And according to Justin's suit, his tested better with their like sample audiences, but Blake insisted that her cut go to screens or she wouldn't promote the movie. And she was just like a very difficult personality. But it's also like, I can see a world where this is a very interesting character study. Like it's like in our world of watching these like anti-heroines like act like jackasses, but being held at a different standard than your usual male jackass. It's just like really compelling to me. And I would love like an actual biopic about this moment in time, because it's like Blake was like insisting on people bringing all the wardrobe items to her house instead of her going to set because she wanted to try things on and then add things from her wardrobe. Or she like had the set right. She was improvising lines, even though that wasn't like a part of the deal and not really a style that either any of the production team wanted. She was like improvising or rewriting lines day of. And so it's just like, I'm very compelled for a visual recreation of the entire production of this film, because it does sound messy and you know I love mess. So I'm hoping that one day can pan out and we can get the It Ends With Us
Ryan Murphy somewhere is buying the rights as we speak.
Yeah, like, American Horror Story.
Well, Feud, I think. Wouldn't that be Feud? Yeah, Beldoni versus Lively or whatever. I mean, also, it's just like, you can sense that Ryan Reynolds, like, who is a more successful, like, what he did with Deadpool is so much based on him and sort of his being like, this isn't how this has been done, but I think that we could do it this way. And it was so successful that you know that she's like, oh, yeah, and I am the same way. Like, I'm going to make some changes. I'm going to do whatever. Like, I am also this, like, visionary auteur. Yeah. And it's like, okay, one, I just don't think Blake Lively is necessarily that talented in general. But also, like, this isn't your movie necessarily, and like it wasn't your idea, like I don't know, it's just so. But then at the same time, Justin Baldoni also seems sort of like an asshat and annoying to work with in other regards. So it's like you just really got a perfect storm of these two people hating each other, and I think this probably happens all the time on movie sets, but they both of them are just so immature and entitled that they are like throwing it out here for the press, where I think like who likes working with Jack Nicholson? Like probably not that many people, but they're smart enough to be like, I'm not gonna like this is gonna be mutually assured destruction if I bring this up.
No, I love every single text. I mean, and it's hard for me to absorb it because it's always filtered through like some very biased like content creator who's like, oh my God, look at this bitch. And it's like, well, actually, I could see a world where she's like a new mom and she's like, please bring the wardrobe over here. I can't like get out right now. You know, like whatever. Like there's always another side or anything. But it is funny to see them share so much just in the very text they like include in these suits, that it's just like, you really do get an insider's look at everything from the production to the promotion cycle to then the editing, like all of it is just out there for us plebs to just enjoy. And that's the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, also, I don't even think that we have the full extent of all the information yet, because there was a whole nother section of the Blake Lively original lawsuit where they were like, how did she even get all of this information? Because this isn't a criminal lawsuit. So it's not like the court subpoenaed Jason Baldoni and got all of these texts. So it's sort of like, where did they come from exactly? And then in the countersuits, obviously like Jason Baldoni is like submitting his own stuff, but it's like, they're each submitting things that make themselves look good. So presumably once we get to an actual like court case in whatever that is, then we'll have all of the information from both sides, not just these cherry picked bits. Because I'm sure that there's texts between from Blake Lively to Ryan Reynolds or whatever, you know, that are like not that we have not seen that are going to be more interesting.
I love it. And I did try to watch the movie and it was not good, so
I have not watched the movie, but I think I'm most intrigued by to figure out like to see Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds, like whatever their conversation was, trying to make it the new Barbenheimer, because you know that the two of them were like, yes, this is it. Yeah. Like Deadpool and whatever. What is this movie called?
It Ends With Us.
It Ends With Us. I keep just calling it Bring Your Florals.
and is Get your girlfriends, wear your florals.
Wear your florals, which is just so funny and so stupid to me. And I'm like, anybody?
I think there was a piece of the like, oh, in Blake's suit where she was like, they told me to promote it casually. Like, I feel like I didn't read deeply, so maybe I'm misremembering, but I do feel like that was part of it where it was like part of this coordinated campaign rested on how badly she botched the promo, but like she's claiming that there was some guidance given to her that she was following. I don't know.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes. I do feel like I read something like that too, where it was like, oh, the studio had sort of wanted to go in a lighter way, but yeah, then Justin Baldoni had like purposefully said he wouldn't do that. But it's like sort of no matter who you are, you should be able to read the room. You know, it's like if I'm in Zone of Interest and the studio is like, promote it like it's a fun movie, I'm not going to be like, hey, everybody, like, you
know. Family Vacation's in
yes. It's a fun little summer resort movie. Everybody wear your visors and wear the fur coat that you stole from a dead Jewish woman. Come to the movies. Like,
there were some mistakes made.
Wait, but speaking of the Holocaust, I did love Blazer's joke during the Golden Globes where she was like, oh, look who it is, 2-time Holocaust survivor, Adrian Brody. I was like, that's a great line. Like, so many good zingers. Yeah. Okay, well, the biggest piece of news that I have to share was that Charlie XCX's Letterboxd was leaked. Did you investigate this situation at all?
Of course I did not. This did not come across my...
Well, it came across my desk. It is the perfect, like, zen meeting of the minds for me. But Charlie XCX is, you know, has been a very active Letterboxd user for... you know, the past couple of years has been logged all of this stuff. I don't think you can be private on Letterboxd randomly, actually, now that I think about it. But anyway,
like a burner account?
Well, it's like she had an account that she, you know, was just like, it wasn't like she was hiding it necessarily, but she just like hadn't promoted it. And then there wasn't like an emoticon or whatever. Like clearly she was using it for personal reasons to just sort of log movies that she'd seen. And so, but then you can see all of her reviews and comments, you know, they're like, oh, I went and saw this with George, blah, 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 like the stuff. But the funniest bit was that she said that she saw Challengers the day before the Met Gala, and she liked the movie so much that her and her friends went out till 5 a.m. and she was really hungover at the Met Gala. And the next day she went to IFC Center to watch a movie to like unhang over from it. And people were like, yeah, just imagine like being at IFC and having Charlie XCX like show up with all of these like three old people to watch some random movie and like a Tuesday, I guess. And then people were like pulling the dates that she had watched things and comparing them to the dates that she was performing. And it was like, oh, on the day she did this, she also watched two movies. Like, what have you guys been doing with your life? She's logged like over 200 films last year, despite, you know, all of her other stuff that's going on. So it was really, it was just
did
very
she have
fun,
good
I
taste?
Thought.
Did you appreciate
yeah,
her?
Yeah, she has pretty good taste. Yeah. Nice. She's watched a lot of like in very interesting things. So yeah, Charlie XCX continues to be my fave, and I do support me stanning her, obviously. So
yeah.
Do you have other news, or should we get into the love it or hate it?
Let's get into love it or hate it.
I mean, there's so much to discuss here. I mean, we could talk about Baby Girl, which I hated. We could talk about Sonic the Hedgehog 3, I did love. There's a new season of Drag Race that just started. There's a lot going on. But yeah, I guess something to discuss for better or for worse is the Mufasa movie.
Where did you land on this?
I landed on, I think the movie is actually heinous, like horrible, horrible, horrible. I mean, for all the reasons that we've said a million times, like why are we doing this? And the story makes no sense. And the CG is bad. And it's like,
well, I mean, it's good. Like, it's very beautifully
animated. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I guess, I mean, it's it's live action, but it's like not, yeah, it's animated. Like, it's soulless, weird. Yeah. Yeah, it's just a very strange thing.
Yeah.
But I will say that the one gem of the movie, I think, is the songs in it to a certain degree. Oh, there, which Lin-Manuel Miranda did. There is one that's sort of baffling, where the villain keeps singing about go bye-bye, which is just like, what? Like, how did this get approved to be in this movie?
No, hear me out is Mads Mikkelsen as a lion, as a as an albino lion. I was like, damn.
But then, big year for animals with weird fur things, between the alopecia baboon in Gladiator 2, and now the albino lions,
the white lions
in Mufasa. Yeah, but the best song of the movie is the brother song, listened to it about 9 million times. From anecdotal Twitter evidence, this seems to be taking the, you know, elementary schools by storm, and I'm like, they really should have tried to get an Oscar for this song, because I'm like, it is catchy as hell. I agree.
Matt, Rob hates it. Rob is like, this is the worst song. I'm like, no, it is catchy. It does what it needs to do, and it's like, how do you decide on what is a good song and what is a bad song? Because to me, it's like that's pop. That's gold. That's working. But he's like, it feels like it was written too fast. And I'm like, I mean, friggin' Dolly Parton wrote Jolene in 5 minutes. Like, what do you mean written too fast? You know, like, it's like, I always wanted a brother. Don't take a swipe at my brother. That's going to be my brother. Like, that's art. Okay.
It's like, whoever I want. I also,
they're singing about birds for some reason. Like, they're
yes. Speaking of texts I want released, like, was it Lin-Manuel who decided to say brother in such a weird way? Was it
a brother? I always wanted a brother.
But it's like, it's so long, like brother. And the way it goes up at the end, it's like it ingrains itself in your mind. But I don't know, like, while you were writing a song, if you would think of that. Like,
no, of course.
Like I'm going to say it in this weird as hell way. Or was it like the 12-year-old who was recording it, who just sang it that way and they liked it? Like, how did this work?
I always wanted a brother. I think that was scripted. I think that was an important element. That was the ego. That was the hubris coming out of the little lion. You know, he's like, it's the entitlement. It's the, I'm a prince and I get what I want and I want a brother. You know, it's very Veruca Salt.
It's also so weird, just as a like, because they're working off of the original Lion King, it's like they have to explain strange things, which, for example, Scar had a British accent. So then in this movie, it's like, oh, this one tribe of lions is British and this other tribe of lion is not. And that's why Mufasa and Scar have different accents, despite the fact that they're supposedly brothers, because one is actually adopted and whatever. And then also, you get to the end of the movie, and it's like, okay, it's a prequel, so there has to be a plot. But then at the beginning of The Lion King, it's like, obviously Scar and Mufasa don't necessarily get along, but like, they are still cohabitating and in communication with each other. So how do you, like, have Scar kind of betray Mufasa in this movie, but then like have Mufasa sort of take him back, and they're gonna have to be friends for another however many years. Like, it's just full of so many weird things that they're like working around. Yeah. And then they're like, oh, and this is how Zazu showed up, and it's just like,
how Rafiki got his cane.
Stupid. So stupid. How a random earthquake like knocked down Pride Rock into the formation that it's in. Just so freaking dumb.
Why are these giraffes and hippos bowing to a lion on a random Tuesday? I mean, yeah, it was a lot. I honestly was so like disturbed by its existence. And the whole time, you know exactly, like, you know Taki's Scar. Like, it's like, what are we doing here? Like, why are we pretending this isn't Scar? Like, and it's like meant to be this revealed, like, I'll let you stay, but I can never call you Taki again. And it's like, why? And so then they're like, it's Scar. And I'm just confused, because I don't know much about lion procreation, but I do feel like it's not going to take long for Mufasa and Sarabi to birth Simba. And so I just feel like...
Simba, who's their only child. And I'm like, wait, how does that work? Because I think lions also have more than one kid at once.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's true. Sometimes, yeah. But I do feel like it would have been better if Mufasa didn't know Scar had betrayed him, because then that would make sense for the lineup to Lion King.
Right. Yeah.
Because Mufasa's kind of like, woohoo, Scar's kind of grumpy, but he's my bro. And whereas this, it's like, they need to talk about it. Like, I honestly blame Mufasa in a lot of ways for just brushing that under the rug so quickly. And if that's my main takeaway of your prequel, then I think you've got some story issues, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I do wish we were talking about Mufasa, because I honestly could talk about it for a long time. It was so many choices were made. Oh, but too bad. Because we're going to talk about Nosferatu instead.
Yes, which shocking that Shelby even saw. But what is your love it or hate it, Shelby?
Oh, yeah. I do want to offer a different perspective on Baby Girl.
Oh, okay.
I saw it. I didn't love it, but I do feel like you were like, oh my gosh, they're trying to be so kinky and this isn't kinky. But I don't think it was trying to be like the kinkiest thing two people could ever do. I think it was a very specific story about this one woman who's trying to bridge the orgasm gap. You know, it was like these two sort of broken people kind of like stumbling through understanding themselves through each other. And I thought that was interesting. I feel like it lost it in the third act, where it became very like, oh, everyone lives happily ever after, and I'm back with my husband who finally knows how to pleasure me. But I did like parts of it at the beginning, where it was like them awkwardly stumbling through this, I don't know, sort of BDSM light relationship that they're both like new to. Like, and I thought that was curious and unexpected, with him not being sure what to do either. And they're both kind of just like, I don't know. So I appreciated that.
I think my problem with the movie wasn't the like kinky part of it necessarily. I think my problem with the movie was that I felt like it never really explained mostly who he was and why he was there and why he was there. Like, I felt like for it being a pretty much a two-hander, like, we got very little information on him in a way that felt sort of befuddling. And then I thought that her, because we didn't really know very much about him, like, I felt like neither of the characters were like fully developed in a super interesting way. And I thought that there could have been a lot more of that. And then also, I thought that while Nicole Kidman's performance was good, I thought it was also sort of weird in a typically Nicole Kidman sort of fashion, where it's just like, this doesn't feel like a human being. Like, neither of these people feel like humans that I've ever seen before. And this entire interaction that they have also feels completely otherworldly. And I sort of don't know what we're doing with it.
Yeah.
And the director herself said that she like wrote this movie and directed it to sort of like work out her own sort of like repressed sexuality, because she didn't feel like she was a super sexual person, which I think also contributes to the fact that it feels like the movie is sort of sorting itself out as it goes along. It doesn't have a super strong viewpoint on things. But I felt that people were so obsessed with the movie because like straight people who aren't super kinky were getting so caught up in the sex element of it that it sort of like glossed over everything else, that they were like, this movie's crazy. And I was just like in such a state the entire time I was watching it. Like, wasn't it amazing? And it's like, well, maybe like, take a cold shower and rewatch it again, and then we can sort of like parse through some of these problems.
I enjoyed the performances. I thought the choice to have him dancing to "Let Me Be Your Father, Baby," or what is the song?
Oh, Father Figure. No, yeah, it's like there was lots of stuff that I did really like the scene where he like sends her the glass of milk and then later comes up to her and is like, "Good girl." Like, I thought it was a lot of very fun scenes. I just it felt like a movie that was like not fully formed. And then also I thought that it was really interesting, the plot line with her assistant, where her assistant is like, you're a female leader.
Yeah,
like, I don't want you.
Yeah.
And I don't, and I sort of have to protect you to sort of like protect us, but also I'm going to use this to get myself ahead. Like, I thought there was a lot of interesting components that just never really came together worked in any capacity. And then for people to be like, this was the best movie of the year, I was like, no, this is ridiculous. Like,
maybe it was a metaphor for sexual frustration, because the first two acts did excite me. Like, I was really into it. And then once they were found out, and it was like there was a showdown between the two men, and the assistant was sort of like giving her this lecture, it did get sort of like, the daughter shows up and is like, he'll forgive you. I was like, okay, like, this is getting too like twee. Like, this is getting too, we've lost the plot here. Whereas watching her sort of blow up her own life and like panic about it in real time was the more interesting and compelling piece. But yeah, once it was sort of like, okay, adventure over, like, let's wrap this up. It was just kind of like, okay, I mean, that was fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if people had, I think it was just like expectations versus reality. Like, I think if people had sort of been like, this movie sucked, I would have been like, wait, you guys, like, this movie actually has a lot of really cool components to it. But because people came into it so, like, sort of like with The Holdovers last year, where it's like, if everyone else had been sort of like, eh, The Holdovers, I'd have been like, this is actually like sort of a funny Christmas movie. Like, I do enjoy. Yeah. But the fact that everyone was like, this is the best movie that has ever come out, sort of made me be like, oh, wait a second.
I was fascinated by the timeline of this movie, because it starts basically at a Christmas party, but then it ends at a New Year's party. I mean, it's still December, isn't it? Like, it was like very compact. And I was like, there is a lot happening here. There's a lot of liaisons being built into this little 3-week period. And well, that was very curious to me.
The whole whatever like internship program that he's in, like,
what are
he's
doing?
Like 29, but he's like doing an intern. It was like, what? Like, how did you get
some
this?
People go to college late, Matt. Okay, you can't
Yes, but again, like, we could have had two lines to explain that, and instead it was just like, no, it's weird.
His dad was an artist who then went to prison, right? That was his, he has a line about that. And she was in a cult, which was very curious to me.
Right. Again, like, people just dropping things that aren't like
a big movie for cult moms, because that's the story of Night Bitch too. Her mom, they grew up in a cult, right? Or like a super religious sect.
I liked Night Bitch.
No, it was fine. It again felt like something where I was like, okay, like, I've heard this before. I don't feel like it brought anything new to the conversation, and it sort of diffused its own interesting bomb in the final act when it just like made it all better and she had another baby in the end. I was just like, what are we saying here? And I wish it had stayed in the surreal more. Like, I wish she'd been fully dogified.
Well, because you haven't read the book, right?
No.
Like, she basically like kills the cat with her teeth in the book. And I was like, I wanted more of those kinds of scenes where she's like actually turning into dogs and like doing more violent sort of things, rather than just like a couple of shots of her eating meatloaf at Trader Joe's. I mean, which were funny in and of themselves. And I do think that Amy Adams is very good in it. And it like, and is it, it's a deceptively hard performance to like deliver all of that without it being insane. I've also had the line, I could crack a walnut in my vagina, stuck in my head for months now. So, which I think is an all-timer.
I think as I watched it, I was like, oh, this must be how I feel, must be how Matt felt watching the Barbie movie. Because I was like, I was like, okay, like, if you're going to take on like criticism of motherhood, your final act can't be her continuing in the same, like, her husband finds out how hard it is, but I don't know, I just didn't believe it. It was like she got everything she wanted because she finally like took time for herself. Like, I don't know, I was just kind of like, okay, thanks.
It was a little bit No, I agree with you on that front of sort of like, oh, we're saying that, oh, motherhood is so hard. And then it's sort of like, but you can have it all. Yeah. If you just would. And it's like, well, no, the point of this movie was that sometimes you can't have it all. Like, yeah, sometimes it's too hard to do all of these things and you don't have enough time in a day. So, yeah, like, something, you have to sacrifice something.
Yeah.
And it's either you sacrifice, like, your relationship with your child, or you sacrifice your, like, business stuff.
Or yeah, and I think it's telling that we only allow, like, white women, white moms to get it all. Like, so many black motherhood movies are so sad, so tragic, like they end in disaster. And it's never like, la-di-da, suburbia is such a joy once you figure out the balance. And I find it kind of exhausting to continue to have these like complicated white women who are like, wait, I've lost my artistry. Like, I can't connect with myself, which is a real feeling. But it's like when we're pretending this is life or death and this is pushing someone to the brink of like becoming a literal dog, then it's like the answer can't just be like, but I talked about my feelings and now I'm all better. Cause like sometimes, like, I don't know. It just felt like, okay, I've seen this story before. Like, it's great. Good. Congratulations to all involved. Happy you got it. You got your, you got right back on the horse and you have your own like art showing, you know, 1 year later. Like, mm-hmm, I'm proud of you. Good for you.
Yeah, 100%.
Anyways.
And this is sort of like your art show, Shelby, our podcast.
Yeah.
And I am sort of like your friends who come to dinner once in a while and force you to dress up and then ask
you're just so interesting. Questions. Yeah, you're working so hard and I'm just like, oh, Penny.
Exactly. And then you stand up and say, I could crack a walnut with my vagina.
And they all still came to her show. Proud of them.
I mean, if someone said that to me, I'd be like, I will be coming to everything you invite me to for the rest of my life. You are kooky as hell. And who knows what might be coming out of your mouth next. Okay. Well, speaking of kooky as hell, we will be discussing Nosferatu on Thursday's episode. So stick around for that. Happy New Year to everyone, and we'll see you then. Bye.